This is the Urban Political,
the podcast on urban theory, research, and activism.
So thank you for tuning in today for our episode on revolutionary movements in Algeria and Lebanon in times of the pandemia. We welcome today Ratiba and Rana to provide us with insights on these movements that have come to a head in 2019 and that are now faced with managing the COVID-19 threat. Rana and Ratiba, please let our listeners know who you are, where you're based, and what you usually work on.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for Marcus and Ross for giving us this opportunity. My name is Rana Sukkariye. I am a fifth-year PhD candidate, currently writing my dissertation on how transnational social movements build sustained solidarity. And I'm specifically focusing on the Palestinian boycott, divestment, and sanction, the BDS movement in Toronto. Currently, I am based in Beirut, in Lebanon, where I'm teaching at American University of Beirut. And my research interests are mainly in the context of social movement of the Middle East, transnational social movements, and critical qualitative methods.
Okay. My name is Ratiba Haj Musa, and I am professor in the Department of Sociology at York University. I am mainly interested in the ways in which the political is taught, but specifically in terms of how the political is related to the ordinary. So I am have been working on public spheres, mainly public spheres as related to satellite televisions, and inquiring about how small acts can be prefigurative to major political events. So this is the kind of transversal kind of work on the political. Have been working on the voice of the peripheries coming out from regional and remote areas, and the contestations and the protests specifically of the unemployed in southern Algeria. And I am interested in various, I would say, topics, specifically the political and the forms of the political, now in terms also in institutions, how the political is framed by the institutions and the response to it from various groups in the society. And also I am also interested in memory, public memories, and alternative memories. And I'm based in Toronto, Ontario, Canada.
Great. Thank you for your introductions. Today I'm here with my colleague, Ross Beveridge. My name is Marcus Kipp. And to get us started, I'd like you to give us a short story of the revolutionary movements, the most recent movements in Algeria and Lebanon. I'd like to hear a bit more about the larger context in which they have emerged, a bit about who the actors are, what their goals are, and the tactics that are employed, and maybe focusing for now on the time 2019 prior to the COVID situation, about which we're going to talk about later.
Okay, I will start. I think the movement which we call the Hirak in Algeria, is a movement that started actually in mid kind of average cities in the eastern part of Algeria. And the movement was against the fifth term for the presidency of President Bouteflika, who was has been president for four terms. So, as you know, President Bouteflika was sick and couldn't even perform his duties. And so I think most of the reactions were against the fact that he was still presenting himself or as a candidate. And that was the first kind of reactions in the small cities. You need to know that this was possible because this occurred actually in small cities because the centers like Algiers was completely blocked, and so that is the demonstrations were not allowed. Any kind of demonstration, even small demonstrations, were completely shut off by the police. And so that was the opportunity came from what I call the peripheries. And so the peripheries became one of the major force, political force, in Algeria at that time. So what can I say about the reasons? The reasons were not only economic, because we tend to think that people react in those countries because they don't have enough economic resources. Yes, but I think most of the claims of this the Hirak are political, and they were asking for democratic reforms, including the changes of the constitutions. And that gave full power to the president and deprived the parliament of any kind of decisions. The end of corruptions, which is also linked to the economic sectors and to what people there call the oligarch. They were also asking for free associations and the abolitions of the regimes of authorizations to the association, those free associative organizations. So as you may need to know that in 2012, there was a change, a major change to the creation of the associations. So that is civil societies, groups. And they were subjected to what they call an agrément, which is an authorization from the authorities. And this was a very big obstacle to create anything at the social level or economic level or even the political level. The possibility for political parties to meet, because it was very hard for political parties to meet and to have meetings with the populations, and have the possibility also to the claims to demonstrate freely in the cities when the population or the groups decided for. So that's what at the political level. There was also an economic level to it, because since 2014, that corresponded to the fourth term of the presidency of Bouteflika, the kind of the economy kind of stopped. And from 2014 to 2019, there was almost nothing. There was a blockage. Everything dropped out, such as, for example, the foreign reserve assets. In 2013, there was the Algeria had 194 millions in foreign reserves. That means the capacity for Algeria to import for 3 years. In 2019, it had the number dropped, and it was the reserves of only 80 million US dollars, which is very, very, very important, actually, a drop. So in terms of the economy, I would start with the employed, because these are very important to me, and I think to Algerians as well. There were about 1 million and 500,000 unemployed, and among them 29% youth from the age of 16 to 24, and most of them, half of them, were graduates. So you also have to keep in mind that the public sector, which was a major employer in the past, is falling apart, and the sector has a really structural problems, and the capacity of productions was underused. There was an underuse of the production capacity, which was evaluated in 2019 at 49%, which is half of the possibilities. We have to add to this that there is a private sector, and the private sector is very slow to take off. This is due to the weight of bureaucracy, corruptions, and the lobby of the importers. So the lobby of importers, because in Algeria there is a joke, and it says like importer importers, l'import import, which means that we just import but we don't export. It's not an economy of exportation or export economy. Sorry. Just to give you a number of the private sectors. The structure of the private sectors, there is about 90% of small family companies. Most of them are operating in the informal sectors. There are also big companies, like private companies, but mainly in building and public work sectors. So, you know, the big infrastructures, roads and buildings. But they're not independent. They are actually very much related to the political elite. And most of them at the present time, most of these, what they call oligarchs, are in prisons because they were linked to invasive, strong corruptions in Algeria. So this is what actually, these are the different elements or reasons that triggered the uprisings. But we have also to add a very important element, which is a psychological element, like a subjective element. And this was the feeling of Algerian, feeling that they are humiliated. They were humiliated. They felt the fifth terms of Bouteflika as a huge humiliation. And I think this is the reason for which the people started the Hirak And I can talk about the unfolding of the Hirak later on, but I'm just answering your questions about the reasons and what triggered the Hirak in 2019.
Thank you, Ratiba. Just a curiosity, what does Hirak mean?
Hirak means movement in Arabic. That's the thing. So we there is a Hirak in Morocco as well, a very important one. It means movement. It doesn't mean it's a kind of it's not a social movement. It's in this case for the Algerian Hirak, it's not a social movement. It's a popular movement. It's different because it includes all the, I would say, the different affiliations, the different political affiliations and sensibilities. That is, the youth, non-affiliated, most of the time they're not affiliated politically. But also, it includes some parties, not all the parties, because the parties was also kind of, there was, they were not accepted necessarily in the Hirak, specifically at the beginning, because they were seen as the hand of the regime. The right hand of the regime, and so the youth, some left associations, and also the FIS, which is the Le Front Islamique du Salut, which is the Islamic Front of Salvation, that was forbidden in 1992, and actually also triggered the civil war. But you could find also those the members, the former members, not the responsibles, but the former members of the FIS in the groups. And what it was interesting is that this popular protest had one objective is to get rid of the regime, and despite the differences, because Algerians were, I would say, divided on the basis of those different ideologies, but also the regimes, the political regimes, played on those divisions and make the coalitions or any kind of working together impossible. So the Hirak, in fact, has been very successful in putting together all these political sensibilities.
Thank you, Ratiba. Rana, do you want to continue with your account on Lebanon?
Sure, yeah. So on the 17th of October, what became the eventful event, I'm using the social movement terminologies. On that day, the government decided to impose new taxes in its proposed 2020 budget, including a $6 monthly tax on WhatsApp calls, which is widely used among citizens in Lebanon because it's relatively cheap. So immediately after the news announced that this is the proposed budget, proposed new taxes, there was an unprecedented popular uprising across all the cities in Lebanon, all the geographies, and it included almost a multiplicity of identities, of different sects, of generation, young, old people, and different political affiliations. So that day, and then the next day, actually the next, maybe I would say a couple of days, the protesters on the street reach almost 1 million in a country that has 6 million citizens, which is huge. So, but it's very important to know that 17th October, 2 days before that, the government was unable to extinguish massive forest fires in the Lebanese mountains because the firefighting planes were not maintained. so which is a sign of corruption. And this also, the 17th of October, happened after several weeks of a devaluation of the Lebanese currency in the black market and few very short-lived strikes in essential sectors, such as the fuel or the bakery sector. So it's not really the WhatsApp, the $6 monthly tax on WhatsApp calls that that led to this uprising. But in reality, it is there has been ongoing protests and strikes for years that led to this eruption of the in the current uprising. In terms of the demands are definitely rooted in a lot of socioeconomic malaise, where since the post-war era, so Lebanon had witnessed a civil war for 15 years between 1975 and 1990. And then the post-war reconstruction era adopted a lot of neoliberal policies that focused on the construction, on the rebuilding of the heavily destroyed infrastructures. They focused on the roads, on the financial touristic sector, privatization of major industries. At the same time, they were neglecting all investment in productive sectors. They were neglecting the investment in public sector, including public schools and public health, for example. So as a result of these policies, the governments were, the recurring governments since the 1990s, they adopted over-borrowing policies, mainly from the local banks and at very high interest rate. So this led the economy to enter in a vicious circle where the governments were obliged to borrow new loans to finance the interest of the previous loans. So put it in figures, just to give you an idea, the debt in Lebanon grew from 50% of GDP in 1993 to 150% of the GDP in 2018. So one of the crises we have, because we do have multiple crises in Lebanon coming together, one of the crises we have is this economic crisis, where we do have very high debt. Another one is the financial crisis, where the government adopted a policy of stabilizing the Lebanese, pegging the Lebanese currency to the US dollar and stabilizing it at 1,500 lira per dollar since 1997. But in reality, this stabilization was really fake. And it led to the deterioration of the currency that we are witnessing at the moment. Another reason that why we had this, like in general, I'm discussing why we had this uprising is similar to Algeria as well. We do have high level of unemployment among young Lebanese. We do have high underemployment, especially among university degree holders. Dysfunctional economy, there's increased level of corruption, and there's lack of accountability. Increased level of corruption, it's not only about, so the corruption took many, many forms. So for example, it can be direct or indirect theft, but it can be also conflict of interest. So just to give you an example about the conflict of interest, so as I mentioned before, that most of the financing for the reconstruction of Lebanon after the war came from the Lebanese banks that are owned, the shareholder of the Lebanese banks are mainly owned by the political families that control Lebanon. So there is a study done by Dr. Shaban, who's a Lebanese economist, who shows that eight political families, only eight, They control 32% of the commercial banking sector total assets. So if I look at this, this is a form of course, there's conflict of interest, and this is a form of corruption, because here we have people that vote and that promote and vote for getting loans from banks that they themselves, they own. So there is this entrenched corruption. And at the same time, the corruption was, we can definitely say that it is the main endemic problem in the country. And a country that is deeply divided among sects. So we have 18 sects in Lebanon, different political affiliations. And after the war, they have agreed that we want to have the power sharing system in Lebanon. So power sharing arrangement for all the state resources. So this small country with all the diverse religious and partisan groups, including some war militias, they have agreed that this whole pie, we want to divide it among ourselves, which solidified the religious sectarianism. And this religious sectarianism was cascaded down to everything, actually. So if I look, for example, at the unions, when you think that you say, oh, where are the unions? Can they be in, can they defy what the government is doing? We look at that the unions have been manipulated and co-opted by the political parties, which they have been totally paralyzed, and they totally diverted their interest from protecting the workers into serving the competing political parties and so on. So we have neoliberal policies, we have high debt. Since last year, no, not last year, 2000, maybe 17, we started witnessing as well deterioration in the financial sector. And more specifically, Lebanon is an import country. Like Ratiba said about Algeria, it is the same for Lebanon. Almost 80% of the food, for example, we imported from outside. So we have to pay in US dollar. And the US dollar, usually we get a lot of, most of the money get is from the remittances of Lebanese that are outside Lebanon, so they send to their home, to their families here, and these remittances have decreased in the last few years for many reasons. One of them can be attributed to the global recession that we did not really overcome since 2008 crisis. So people, let's say Lebanese that are in the Arab Gulf, they are not sending money as they used to send in the past to their parents. So that's one. But also another reason is that the American alleged war on terror, quote unquote, has definitely impacted Lebanon. So they have been monitoring all the remittances that that the Lebanese diaspora, especially in African countries, where they usually send their money here to Lebanon, and because they have imposed some sanctions on supporters of a Lebanese party, which is Hezbollah. And that has impacted the amount of remittances coming to Lebanon as well. And so all of these, we need to take that into consideration. And that's why we have 17 October, we have the uprising. And in terms of terminology, some people call it uprising, some people call it Hirak movement, or some people call it revolution, Thawra. There's still no real agreement on that. Depends on what exactly do you see? So this is the, if you want, the socioeconomic roots of this uprising.
I think there is something that I would like to add in here that I didn't mention, and it's the 2011, and it's related to the Arab Spring, and it's actually I don't know if it's a coincidence or not, but I would say the Arab Spring started in Algeria, because in 2011, in January 2011. There were a lot of riots, and as my work is on riots, actually, I worked a little bit on riots, and so in 2011 there were riots against the price of the prices of sugar and flour, and very quickly the political regime decided to subsidize, because what we have to keep in mind is that Algeria is a little bit different from Lebanon in this case, because most of the goods are subsidized, and there is a very important social net. Algeria being one of the countries that have, for example, achieved universal primary educations with even 70% primary net enrollment rate, as the numbers in 2011 mentioned. But just to say that there was an uprising in 2011, and subsequent to this uprising, the regime decided to in a way that was absolutely non-conform even to any kind of rationality, but rationality of a regime that felt that people started to react, and that they, to appease the fire, they started to distribute the money specifically to youth, to in programs, in employment youth programs that had absolutely no impact on the unemployment, and that was that created a deficit, a budget deficit that Algeria is still actually experiencing right now. And so with the fact that Algerian economy is highly dependent on hydrocarbons and also on global oil and gas prices. So that since 2013-14, the oil prices started to go down from $100 US dollars a barrel. Nowadays it's $30. So if you want, the government or the political regime, I would call it this way, cannot compensate. And they're experiencing a lot of troubles. Add to that, as Rana said, the corruption is even invasive. And lack of accountability actually created an important sentiment of untrust. So people don't trust anything that comes from the government. That's what I wanted to say.
You already, Ratiba especially, I think, mentioned something about the specialities of the protest in terms of it being more focused on the periphery and smaller cities due to, I think, a less strong or dominant kind of police presence or presence of the state. Could you say a little bit more about the forms of protest as well as the specialities in both of the countries?
Sure. Historically speaking, I would say that since 2008 or 2009, or even before 2001, there was the demands from the Berbers, what we call the Berbers, and Amazigh in Algerians, and it's now we use the word Amazigh to speak about the Berber groups. So there was a claims, demands for a recognition of the Berber language and culture. And in 2001, there was the group of the Berbers that are located, which we call the Kabyles, from Kabylia, located in eastern Algeria, actually demanded and formed even grassroots groups and political groups to demand this to make those claims, and they organized an important march in 2001 that actually was subsequent to also a death of a young student. And they wanted to march towards Algiers from the east to the west, to the center, but they were blocked by, of course, the police forces and other groups, and that was a major important event, even if it was not acknowledged as a very important event. So you could see already the protest coming from the peripheries, as I call them, and the center, the cities, the big cities, specifically Algiers, was completely controlled by the police. Not only the normal, I would say, regular police, but also the security police. In 2014, in Algiers, there was this movement called Barakat, which means enough. Was organized against the fourth terms for the Bouteflika's presidencies. They let them do what they wanted to do. That means they let them go to the streets, demonstrate in small groups. But this group, the Barakat group, was in many ways surrounded and controlled. At a certain moment, specifically the day before the elections, they were totally kind of broken, put in prison, and all their members, the leaders, they were in prison, including women. At that time, there were women who were very much involved in that movement. So every single demonstrations or protest in the center, which means in the urban centers, were either controlled, they were completely dismantled, their leaders were not only put in prison or just put in prison and a little bit threatened, but also they were depicted by the media. As you know, in Algeria, the media are state controlled by the media as being working with the enemies, with working what we call the foreign ends. Most of the time, they use la main étrangère to explain the protests that are actually very much internal and coming from internal, very genuine protests. So that was, I think, and this is my hypothesis, is that, or I contend actually, that because of that control over the centers, over the capital and also big cities, the protest actually was in certain ways possible to emerge from, it was possible to the protest to emerge from these peripheries. I just also want to add something to that. In 2011 as well, the unemployed movement started its actions. But it's only in 2013 that actually they built a very sustainable, I would say, movement that was not authorized. It was not authorized. And that movement actually emerged from the South. And it was the first time that people from the South protested in such a huge, important demonstrations. So in many ways, they were very successful. However, in terms of impact, we cannot see the impact of in terms of employment. There were some, policies that were initiated and that allowed the youth from the South to be employed on these big companies, oil companies. The problem is of employment is so important that it was impossible to absorb all the demands. So to get back to the question, there were a lot of signs from small cities and from small remote regions that shows that there was a discontent with the regime. And of course, as you know, it's only when the center, what I call the center, that is the capital, reacts that we can see this little signs that come from the different regions. And I can give a lot of examples about those manifestations from the small cities that were not necessarily taken into account, but it's a kind of a cumulative movement where I'm not saying that it's a cumulative from 1 to 10, but I am saying that it's you accumulate in a very non-organized way those different protests, those different demands that actually at a certain moment crystallized in the movement against the fifth terms for the presidency, and finally spread out and expands to other types of demands.
Okay, in the context of Lebanon, like similar to Algeria, it would be unwise to look at 17th October as being the moment or the event that that erupted out of nowhere. So no, there has been a lot of ongoing protests and strikes since years. But if I need to look at them in terms of urban-rural divide or different geographical locations, most of them were in the city, in the main cities. Don't forget that Lebanon is totally different. Lebanon is very small compared to Algeria. Actually, it's a very small country. So if from the farthest point in Lebanon to Beirut, that's like 1 hour and a half or 2 hour drive, or to the other main cities. So most of the movements were mainly concentrated in the main cities. But if I need to look at the protests and the strikes that were going on for years, these were either they were mainly sector specific. So, for example, there has been a strike for secondary teachers for teachers of secondary level, or there has been strikes for the university faculty. So it was very specific demands for specific sectors. Also, since years, there has been very sporadic, maybe few protests here and there, but that would not be big enough to say that this led to the 17th of October uprising, but definitely they did crystallize, they added up exactly like Ratiba explained, they accumulated, and this cumulative protest led to the uprising itself. But it's more city-centric in Lebanon.
I also want to say that it's also the same thing. Like I haven't talked about the strikes and different strikes. There were thousands of strikes, sectorial strikes between, I'd say, 2009-2019, and also with the creation of the independent union, what we call les syndicats autonomes, that were actually, in fact, very much in many ways deprived by kind of their political actions by the regimes, but they were very successful, specifically in the education sector, where they led very, very important strikes. And also marches from, let's say, Kabylia to Algiers, but they were stopped by the police, of course. But this is a very important thing. But I also want to say something about gender here. Because, as you know, the education sector is a very gendered sector. Women played a very important role in those strikes. With the exception, I would say, for the unemployed huge demonstrations in the southern regions, there were not that many women in there. But with that exceptions, women played a very important role in those different strikes, but also in the Hirak, and specifically young women. And so for the first time, it was even moving to see young women for the first time voicing their concerns. And what was even incredible, it was like an Islamist who was taking the mic for these women, for these students who were claiming the right to speak and the right to decide for their future. So, and this was in the middle, in the center of Algiers and in the center of other cities. So it's we cannot now really assess the importance of the Hirak for the moment in general, but we can say that the actions, those even small acts are so, have in many ways changed the ways in which we could see gender and women's participation to these events.
Ryan, is it possible to say anything comparable, or could you just compare the situation around gender in Lebanon?
Yeah, sure. Actually, it is definitely it's very comparable to Algeria. So in the last uprising, 17 October uprising, there has been, just looking at the streets and seeing the number of young people and women specifically in the street was really astonishing. So even to the extent that there has been a couple of events during the uprising where they specifically discussed Athoura Untha. Athoura Untha means the revolution is a woman. So they really focus, there has been marches that were only led by women. There has been marches where, for example, in one area where during the civil war, there has been a lot of clashes between different sects in that area. And following some tension after the 17th of October in that area, only just some vocal tension between young people, the mothers in these two areas decided that we want to make a march, that we are all in this together, and we are looking to build our future together. So it was totally a women-only march, mainly a women-only march, and led by the women. So what was really astonishing also during the 17th of October uprising is the number of young high school students and university students on the streets. So there has been, they called for days where they will not go to school. They just leave their school and they go on the streets. That was really moving because in a context where the young people are often accused of being apolitical or of being accused of not having a good, maybe political education and consciousness, there, the number of these young students on the street was really overwhelming. It is promising that no, they are interested because one of their slogans, for example, we want to stay here, we don't want to migrate, because we have this issue where every Lebanese, whenever they graduate and whenever they have the opportunity to leave the country, they leave it. So this was a dominant slogan, for example, among young people, that we want to stay here. In terms of women, as I said, like it's that's not to say, okay, do not misunderstand me, that women were not present in the previous protests and strikes. No, they were present, but their presence during the 17th of October was definitely more visible.
Okay, I just wanted to say something about the Hirak itself and the gender, I would say, problematic in the Hirak, because not everything was easy, actually, even for women, because when the Hirak started in February 22nd, 2019, the first Fridays, women started constituted what they called the feminist square or le carré féministe, as other groups also constituted their squares, and they were attacked by young men. And actually, what happens was that this provoked an outrage, a very big reaction, and many actually men reacted to that and helped to kind of, so to speak, protect the feminist square. And from that moment, the feminists actually and women and were, if not, I would say, the major participant, I would say even the leaders. There's something that someone who doesn't know the situation cannot see. If there was demonstrations, only a male demonstrations, I can tell you that the Hirak wouldn't have lasted as it has lasted for a year or so. And it's still going on in different forms. The COVID-19 didn't allow it, but those big demonstrations. But if there were not women, there were not families with children, one can say that 100% that, if not 150%, that the Hirak would not have been possible, would not have lasted at all. So at the beginning, then there was a tension, but that tension kind of faded because there was a kind, as I told you, a coalition. And the discussions around the main objective of the Hirak. And secondly, I would add, because Rana referred to the high school, I would say students who also participated to the Lebanese Hirak, I would say that the students played a very important role in the Hirak. They were actually, I would say, the flame of the Friday's general demonstrations. And their demonstration happened every Tuesdays, and of course the students were mixed men and females, but the females also were their presence and their participations was so impressive that this influenced or had an impact on the Big Friday's demonstrations.
Thank you both. So can we move to the current situation marked by the COVID-19 threat? And I would like you to tell us a bit about how this threat is unfolding in your respective context, and how do the actors involved, both movement and the state, respond to the situation, and how has it changed the dynamics of contestation?
So one of the specificities of, I would say, the arrival of the COVID-19 in Algeria was that it happened already in Europe. So they were witnessing what was happening in particular in Italy and in France. So the political or the government actually organized very quickly a kind of confinement or social distancing, but confinements. And I want to speak about the impact of this confinement on the economy, because we don't have the numbers. We know that there are thousands of jobs that might be lost. But what we can say is that the health sector in Algeria is in a very bad shape. So that actually created a kind of a solidarity that was not provided by the state, or the support that was not provided by the state. I think if I have to summarize what happened in terms of organizing in the Hirak, of course, the Hirak, they decided not to demonstrate because of the COVID-19 and the threats of the COVID-19. And also because they didn't want to be accused to be the transmitters of the the virus, and so what they did in front of a very bad health system, they actually most of the time, specifically for middle classes. Because there are poor, the poor have experienced the COVID-19 differently in big cities, and elsewhere, not only in big cities, but also in particular in big cities, where the neighborhoods are hyper crowded and where you cannot really implement the social distancing or all the advices that. Were given to the populations. So one of the major impact, I would say, was that the Hirak, or the members of the Hirak, transformed themselves into solidarity groups, and sometimes solidarity, like neighborhood solidarity groups, that helped the most vulnerable people, specifically those who lost their jobs, who couldn't, who work in the informal sectors, who are what we call journaliers, which means they are daily workers. They live with what they earn during the day, and so those groups, those Hiraki people, members, were in many ways central to the entire solidarity networks that has been created from the beginning of the confinement. So that was that for me was a very important actually sign that the Hirak is continuing without demonstrating in the streets. And I think the regime or the authority, political authorities understood that, because at a certain moment, there was a city called Blida, which is in a, which is located in the east, south of Algiers, 50 kilometers from Algiers, which was a kind of the center of the COVID. A lot of people were sick, and so they closed the city. They closed this. The authorities closed the cities. So what people did inside the cities, those who had access to goods and foods, agriculture, the agriculture sectors, and so on and so forth, they actually collected the goods, specifically during Ramadan, and they distributed these goods to the populations. But don't forget, these distributions are, of course, material distributions, but they're also kind of, I would say, they have a political they had a political connotations, saying that in a way or another, this the Hirak is continuing, and the authorities actually try to block these trucks, the trucks coming from other regions to help the city, and so on and so forth. So the authorities, I would say, were unable to really face the virus, and were kind of replaced by the solidarity that emerged from the Hirakis, but also from other people. It's not only the Hirakis that were active, but there were also other groups, and it was like it was amazing to see that. And so, for the moment, it's like the things are a little bit suspended, and the Hirak hasn't really articulated itself or reflected upon itself to see what kind of actions they may do, because the confinement is still implemented, and they cannot go beyond this kind of the law, so to speak. Specifically, they cannot go beyond the law because of their responsibility. They feel responsible, and this is also amazing. Not only the sense of solidarity, but also the sense of responsibility that they have towards their neighbors, but also towards the other regions and to the populations.
Okay, in the context of Lebanon, let me go back to maybe December, prior to the COVID-19 situation. So the Hirak started very strong in October. Then it has adopted a couple of tactics and a couple of strategies, and definitely it has weakened with time. So by the time we are talking about, let's say, December, the number of protesters on the street has significantly diminished. It became like maximum 1,000 people, I would say. But this was coupled with a lot of deteriorating financial situation in Lebanon. So what happened is the uprising has accelerated the depreciation of the Lebanese lira, and all the policies that have been adopted by the Lebanese central bank, as well as the commercial banks, which are the most powerful sector in Lebanon. They are the oligarchy in Lebanon. And so what they have done is they did not allow people to have access to their deposits in the banks. So maybe you have money in your bank, but you cannot withdraw your money. So that has accelerated the depreciation of the Lebanese lira. And at the same time, there has been a lot of inflation in the country, inflation of the main essential goods, cleaning material, food, you name it. Like everything has increased their prices because on one hand, we have lack of imports because of the depreciation of the currency, but also there is the lack of liquidity. And later on, when COVID-19 started, the COVID-19 total lockdown in the of the country. So before COVID-19, the movement, the 17 October uprising, has already weakened. It has adopted different strategies. There has been a lot of direct action rather than have this mass mobilization and blockage of roads and total blockage of the country where no one can go to work because they are protesting. There has been some direct action taking place. And sorry, I lost. Okay, yeah, sorry for that. So, and then you have the first case of COVID-19 appeared in February 2020. That was 10 days after that we have a new government and after the new government has been formed. So immediately, because of the physical distancing, because of the lockdown that has been, the medical emergency that has been adopted in the country, there were no protests anymore. So on one hand, there was a weakening of the movement itself because of various factors. Some people want direct action, some people want different strategies, and the whole movement has been weakened. And on the other hand, there has been the COVID-19, where we have a medical emergency right now and we should maintain physical distancing. What emerged from the COVID-19 is somehow similar to Algeria, where there has been a lot of solidarity groups formed by the civil society, some of them that have been active participants in 17 October uprising. But also at the same time, the COVID-19 led to the re-establishment, if you want, and re-solidification of the clientele system adopted by that the political parties perform. So it was an opportunity for the political parties to go and give donation for the people in need. So we have seen branded packages of food, of cleaning materials, these branded by the logo of the political party that are in power, and they were given to the people in need. So if I look at COVID-19, I would say that on one hand, there were solidarity groups mainly emerged from the different NGOs that were very active in the uprising, but I do not see their impact. They're very high, very high. If I need to compare them to the political parties, to what they have done, I would say that the political parties have been more influential.
I just wanted to say also something. I was talking about solidarity, and of course, this was an amazing things to talk about the positive things. But there are also some kind of, I would say, not necessarily negative things, but there are things that we should consider, and they're negative. Sorry. So, what was the impact of the COVID-19 on the Hirak? Of course, as I said, the demonstrations stopped, and that was the moment, like what happened in also Lebanon, that was the moment where the regime took advantage of the kind of public sphere, the public space, because the public space is absolutely important to voicing the popular and the population claims. What did they do now that the streets are empty? They started actually to arrest activists. Most of the activists or leaders or suspected, so to speak, to be leaders, they were such as bloggers, Facebookers, and anyone who vote against the regimes or politics are they're put in prison, specifically journalists doing their work. There's I won't name the journalists because I don't want to single out one person because there are many. So the arrest actually started in the spring, late spring 2019, and then it continued until December, where the election was held, and we thought that there was a kind of appeasement, and then most of the activists who were in prison would be released, but actually it was not the case. Some of the activists and just hierarchies, not activists, being in the hierarchy, just walking with people, were released, but many of them were not. So there is the problem of the arrest, and that's something that actually from my point of view, is a strategy, because people and the hierarchies oriented all their fights and their struggles to towards the support of the people who were in prison, and kind of forget about other issues. That's one of the strategies. There is also with the arrest of activists. There is also the locking up of the media. And specifically, and web media, because as you know, in Algeria, there is the public sector, which is a kind of the controlled sector, and they were independent televisions that were authorized in 2013, but they are offshore televisions, and the population called them the garbage televisions because they are very close to the regimes, and they do not cover. They haven't covered the demonstrations, as is the case for the public actually sector. They didn't cover the demonstrations. So what happens for the independent media and mainly radio web media such as Le Maghreb Emergent, Interlink, TSA, these are newspapers, web media newspapers as well as television, they are blocked. Algerians cannot even listen to them or watch them. From Toronto we can of course see them, but not in Algeria. So you could see that there is a kind of more and more restrictions of free speech, free demonstrations, and it's kind of the political regime is more or less trying to cut the head the head of the hierarchy, thinking that in doing that, the other people, the youth who are in the hierarchy, won't react. However, if we follow up in Facebook, we could see that even if there are Algerians are forbidden from criticizing the regime, there's still a lot of youth who are very much involved in the hierarchy. And if they're not involved in the hierarchy, they are claiming the rights despite the bans There are many bans, as I said, media bans, but also social media bans and so on and so forth. So, of course, the picture is not, not transparent or clear, but you could see that there is there's a kind of counter revolution that is triggered or initiated by the political elites, and with, of course, because partly they still have their clientele, and so this clientele is used to kind of counter all the initiatives that are taken by the people who support the Hirak. So the Hirak is now in a very it's in clear situations. There are a lot of things happening in terms of reorganizations of politics. There are some, for example, youth leaders from the Hirak who actually decided to create a political party. And you have also other youth who decides, because it's a youth thing, this revolution is a youth revolution. And so other youth do not want to create any kind of political initiative because specifically parties, because it's what they do is political, but political parties, because they think that the situation doesn't allow to create such a movement, because you are not allowed to meet, you are not allowed to converse. So there is no way to create anything that can just help the regime to perpetuate itself and to start redistributing the little reserves that they have right now.
Yeah, maybe I can add here, and that's also in conversation with what happened in Algeria, is that the same counter-revolution by the government, by the political elite, has been done here. At the beginning of the lockdown, the police came to downtown Beirut and forcibly removed the tents that are used by the activists to organize public forums to discuss about the uprising. And that was under the umbrella of we should be social distancing and we should not allow crowded spaces. Also, one thing I should mention, that COVID-19 did not prohibit people from going on the streets when they really needed to. So in one day, I think that was last month or in the last 45 days, there has been a real depreciation of the Lebanese lira. So currently we have the fake official one, which is fixed $1 at 1,500 Lebanese lira. And then in one day it reached 4,500 or 4,600, which is a lot of depreciation. So people went on the streets and they disregarded all the physical distancing that they should maintain. They disregarded all the enforcement of this medical emergency situation. And there has been clashes between them, and there has been one martyr that was in Tripoli, in one of the main cities in Lebanon. So it would be totally unfair to say that COVID-19 totally silenced the uprising. No, the uprising is still there in different forms. So either in solidarity groups or sometimes in this sporadic protest.
To think about how these cases that you refer to, that you were giving these rich details about how they relate to each other, how we can think of these movements or these hierarchs as being linked to each other, or what other references outside of their respective countries do these movements draw inspirations from?
I think if we want to try to see some transversal themes, although we have already a lot of transversal themes here, which that we mentioned. I think one of them, there are two that for me that stood for me. One is the end of corruption, because corruption actually corrupts all the level of the social. It's not only the economic level where people gain some advantages, economic advantages, but also the other social levels, even in terms of small little things that you need in your daily lives. For example, having an ID, getting an ID. So that's the corruption is quite invasive and pervasive, and it should. This is what they want. These groups, I think, these movements want to end. The other, and it's not hierarchical. I'm just saying this. The other point I would like to add is the possibilities for the populations to participate to decision making. Political decision makings as well as the economic decision makings. For example, even people who are very educated, we don't know what's happening. Rana gave a lot of numbers. In Algeria, we don't know. It's the opacity. Opacity is the is our. I would say we face the opacity all the time. We don't know. If we want to have numbers, we have some numbers, but those numbers are most of the time either false, fake, or not exact. So that's the thing. So the corruption comes, with the corruption comes opacity. You don't know. There is no transparency. We don't know where we are going, in fact. And everything is still decided in the above. So for me, this the end of corruption is a major claim of the hierarch, and not only the hierarch, also people who are not necessarily part of the hierarch. Because as I said, this is a pervasive thing that goes touch and affects every single level of the interactions, and it's important because we cannot create a democracy just by changing the political regime, or the political structure, institutions by changing, let's say, the parliament. If the people are corrupted, we can change all the parliament, all the people, the members, but we don't change the structure. The second, as I said, is the end of the monopoly of the political monopoly, and that's I think very important because people want to they want to take part of the decision makings, and this is not only a question of Algeria or Lebanon, or let's say Morocco, but it's also a question that concerns all the countries of the region. In Tunisia, for example. People are fighting against this opacity, actually. I have seen recently a parliamentary discourse or speech given by a deputy who accused the president of the assembly, who is the chair of the political party. I don't want to name them. People who are interested, they just can go there, because my example is not against one party or the other, but to show that in Tunisia, despite the fact that they have been going through very important phases, through stages, very important changes, this opacity is still in place, and it's still it's played out at different levels. And so the fight for this country is specifically to go beyond, to try to fight this opacity and to make things as much transparent as possible. Of course, this transparency is not going to be implemented tomorrow. It's a struggle road. It's not something that just happened in a minute. And with it comes would come the consciousness of being represented, not only in a fake way, but being truly represented. And truly represented means that if you're not happy with the decision, you can change it. And that's I don't think it's a dream. It's not a dream. It's a possibility for these countries, and they are doing they're struggling. But I also have to say something. What the Hirak actually showed is really the politics of neocolonialism played by other countries. Even for me, who is a kind of specialist, so to speak, a specialist who knows about neocolonialism, but the Hirak really showed that the interests of other countries, such as the US and France, Britain, and Spain, are so important that they haven't opened their mouths when it came to support democratic claims. And so it's not only internal or regional, but also it's linked to the other neocolonial interests in the region. And these neocolonial interests in the region are so strong that sometimes it needs more than I would say a Hirak. It needs a very strong change, a very strong revolution. And I think some people in the Hirak are aware about this, the moment, I would say, of the Hirak, and the capacity of the Hirak to at least bring some changes in the context of Algeria.
Maybe I will start where Ratiba ended. First, I would like to highlight one point, that when I'm talking about the uprising of 17 October and the activists that emerged and later on that continue, and they call themselves activists, are not really united under one specific demand. Like the main demand here is killon yani killon, which means all of them means all of them. But what does that mean literally? Some of them, they say we need a total collapse of the sectarian regime. Well, yeah, this is definitely a revolutionary demand. Some of them, they touch upon only socioeconomic situation, and they need some reforms. Some others, they need revolution, and so on. So I do not look at the current uprising that has definitely weakened as one homogeneous body. It has been it has been hijacked by some of the political parties that have their interest with the imperial powers. So, and that has been refused by many voices in the uprising themselves. So 2 days ago, there has been a huge mobilization for a protest in the country, and there has been violent protests with clashes and people that have been injured and so on. Many of the voices and the groups of the 17 October Hirak or Intifada, they alienated themselves from this call to do the protest, because they thought that many of the voices before yesterday were serving the interest of the imperial powers. So back to your question. So that's why in Lebanon, it's very, very complicated. So on one hand, you do have the corruption, you do have the socioeconomic situation, and you really need to fight all of these and all the neoliberal policies that have been adopted. On the second hand, you really need to take into consideration that any uprising should not be hijacked by imperial powers to serve their own interests, especially in the context where Lebanon is at the borders with Israel, and there's this continuous attacks from Israel on us. Like just 3 or 4 days ago, when they want to bomb Syria, they just go through the lands of Lebanon, they bomb Syria and come back. So this is just important to highlight how complicated the situation is in Lebanon. Back to your question, I would say that definitely one main result of the uprising that I can see also in many of the uprisings, whether in the Arab world, Mediterranean region, or other places, is the expansion of the public sphere. And where we had a lot of public forums in tents organized in the public, under a tree, it can be in a tent where just people gather and they discuss a specific topic. That was very interesting to follow and very very promising to look that people, especially young people, are coming to really educate themselves, to express their ideas, and to see what alternative we can provide. And another thing that needs to be highlighted is the creation of this new space, a new political space for the young people who do not conceptualize politics as being affiliated with political parties. For them, politics can be the everyday, something that Ratiba works on. And I think Ratiba wrote about it as well. It is in the everyday. It is on the way I go to the university and the roads I need to walk on in order to reach the university. It is the everyday practices. It's not only affiliation with specific political parties or with the voting.
I just want to add on Rana's public sphere expansion, or the expansion of public sphere. I really like that, Rana. Partly because I think this expansion has a temporality, right? We cannot go back to the different types of protests in the region. But we can say that all those protests have actually participated to this expansion of public sphere. What is interesting in the Hirak, as you said, is the the forums that were created during the Hirak. But I would say that the Hirak is not necessarily the only the moment where this these forums were created. For example, during the unemployed movement in 2013, or even during the protest against shale gas. Please correct this, okay, when you work on this. So in southern Algeria, there was those places called Sahata Sumut, right? Places of resistance or solidarity resistance at the same time, to kind of translate this, that were transformed, so to speak, during the Hirak, the different Hiraks here, the Hirak in Algeria, but also the Hirak in Lebanon, into places, as you said, education, not only youth. What was interesting in the Hirak in Algeria was that, as I said, it's a youth movement, but there were a lot of, I would say, adults, parents, grandparents, even. You could see a grandparents with their grandchildren, and it was something that was new, and actually, even mentioned by people who participated to the demo, to the demonstrations. So there was this this kind of education process. Also kind of raising consciousness, discussing about things that were not discussed, that were hidden, or that were not possible to discuss because the public sphere, the public spaces were not open. So those, there were amazing discussions, and there were amazing forums, such as art forums organized by artists, but not only artists, even professors, young people in the popular neighborhoods. I have witnessed, for example, seen those forums in, of course, Facebook, that were actually broadcasting in Facebook, where youth from working class neighborhood, if we translate working class in this way, but it's kind of what we call, I call them popular neighborhoods, and those popular neighborhoods were one of the basis of the Hirak. So the forums were places where people not only discussed about the problems, their claims, but also about history, the hidden figures of the revolutions, the ways in which the revolution was corrupted and transfigured, and the ways in which they could reenacted in the Hirak, and so there was a kind of connections that these people wanted to create between the beginning of the fight against the French and the end or the beginning of the fight against the elite and the political regime, a corrupted political regime. So that this was like a kind of forums where there is a reappropriation of history. And you told me this, Rana, that there was a kind of discussion about what happened. Why did we forget about this? Why that happened, those things, those events happened, we don't know about those events. So it's very interesting to see that that the forums were also places where people don't discuss, of course, about their claims, but that is, for example, as I said, the end of corruption, the participation to decision making, but also how to reappropriate our history. It's amazing how I was amazed by the parallel between a kind of decolonization from France and now decolonizations from this elite. This is what they were saying. We don't need that elite anymore. We want to be free. And in the slogans, actually, it's like al-hurriya, which means liberty or freedom, right? It's this, exactly the same times, the same things that Algerians were shouting in 1962, 1961, specifically in July 1962 when they gained their independence. And though the people are asking during the Hirak, al-hurriya, freedom, that was something that I thought could be related to the expansion of public sphere.
Ratiba, Rana, thank you very much indeed for the incredibly rich accounts you've given of your of the ongoing situation in each of your countries. And it was incredibly informative and also very inspiring. Thank you very much. Thanks to you for listening.
For more information, visit our website urbanpolitical.podigy.io.
Please subscribe and follow us on Twitter.